Welcome. This session is supposed to be a dialogue between people who do simulations and people who do observations. So we're going to start with a few very, very brief presentations. First, three on what some of the simulators are doing and can do and are planning to do, and then three very, very brief ones on what some of the observers would like to see from the simulators. And then we'll have an extended period of open discussion, back and forth, I hope, where observers will tell us simulators what they'd like us to do that would be helpful to them, and we can tell, the simulators can tell the observers what's possible for us to do. So I want to start off with, it doesn't look very good, does it? This is a snapshot from a simulation that's currently ongoing of the density fluctuations. It's 48 megameters wide and 20 megameters deep. It's just started from a duplicated smaller scale simulation, so there's still some symmetry involved because it hasn't gone very long yet. But this has the surface shear layer in it, which developed naturally because we put in an F-plane rotation. And this shows the K omega diagram that Xunwei and Dali have calculated on the left compared to that from the NDI data on the right. And you can see that there's quite a rich spectrum of modes in the simulation. And those, of course, we don't have as rich a collection of modes as in the real sun because we have a small box. But where they overlap, they agree very well. They've also calculated a time distance diagram. And again, things agree very well. The dark line is for the F mode. And the plan now is to use this time distance diagram. This is from an 8.5 hour sequence that we had from the 48 megameter. And they're going to use that to analyze what they think the velocity fields ought to be, and then compare it with what the fields really are. This is the spectrum of the horizontal velocities, and so the black line is from Ben Hathaway, from the MDI data. These colored lines are from MDI and from Trace. These yellow crosses and the black stars. Are from our simulation. And the important point we want to make is that if you look at the spectrum of horizontal velocities, you're seeing all the scales, from the giant cells down to degranulation, that there is no scale picked out at mesogranulation. There may be a very slight enhancement in the supergranulation range, but at most it's a small enhancement there. So there is no special well-defined supergranulation scale. But one thing one has to be careful about is how one does the analysis. So this is from the MDI data where we've done a subsonic, supersonic filtering to separate the convection from the oscillations and compare that with what happens if you first do a time average of the velocities and then take the spectrum. and you can see that time averaging is a very crude spatial filter, and one can do a lot better if one really is careful. And this is consistent, for instance, with the stuff that Deborah and Brad are doing for ring diagram analysis. If you have a coarser resolution, so you're averaging over a larger scale, you see larger structures, as is natural, as one would expect. So this is just another example of the kind of things that one can do.
Bob, may I ask you a question? There's the famous Hathaway filter for removing the effects of the oscillations in a Doppler signals from...
The oscillations, if you look at vertical velocities, the oscillations show up. If you look at the horizontal velocities, you don't see them particularly.
Yes.
This is from a simulation of the group from Max Planck, showing what happens when you have a horizontal flux tube that comes up through the surface. And again, an example of the kind of things that one can do. So you can see, you know, the kinds of effects, and you could then look at this kind of thing again with the local time distance analysis to see what kind of signatures it might have.
It's compressible?
What?
It's compressible simulation? Or
yes.
Inelastic?
Just one other word of warning, that whereas the strong magnetic fields are confined to the network, in this case there's no supergranulation network, just a mesogranulation network because it's a small box, but there's weak fields all over the place. And if you're going to be sensitive to them, you had better watch out. Finally, just to tell you some of what we are planning on doing, we're now running this supergranulation scale simulation, which is 48 megameters wide and 20 deep, which includes F-plane rotation, so a surface shear layer develops. Right now, we're just looking at the non-magnetic case to get that relaxed. The turnover time is about 2 days vertically, and at the bottom, it's about 4 days horizontally. So we want to develop the full supergranulation scale stuff. Then we'll put in the magnetic field and see how that evolves. We also plan to do an active region where we'll take some observations from the surface and just extend it down and let the convection start pushing it around. In addition, both we and the group of Schussler and Vogler have been making surface simulations on mesogranular scales with much higher resolution, looking at essentially plage regions where there's a mean vertical magnetic field. We are planning to start a simulation that will have a much higher resolution than we did before, about 6 kilometers vertically and horizontally at the surface. So Mark is now going to say a few things about the plans for the interior calculations.
Bob, can you tell us how much weak field there is in terms of total flux compared to the strong field and how it fluctuates in time?
Not offhand, but we can get that for you if that's what you would like.
I think that's very important to understand the structure of the surface.
Okay.
Hey Bob, the flow with that flux tube emerging, there was a very prominent signal in the granular flow.
Yeah.
Has anything like that ever been observed? You know?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
This was a flux tube that was, a coherent flux tube that was sitting fairly close to the surface.
And a pretty high field strength, I imagine.
Yeah. So. That may be the flux, but from the supergranulation thing, we were intending to put in flux down deeper and get sort of results like people like Bill Abbott were doing for the interior to get a rough idea what they ought to be like at the bottom and then see how it comes up through the surface.
Got rid of my sweater, so hopefully I won't be as staticky. All right, so Bob had just asked me to give a few words about where the global simulations are headed. So this will be very brief. I have, beyond the title slide, I have 4 slides. I'm going to outline 3 objectives, and then the last slide is how HMI might contribute to this effort, hopefully. I think our main thrust in the next 5 years, maybe longer, is going to be trying to understand what's going on in the Taku Climb and the Overshoot region and how this impacts the convection zone, both in terms of the differential rotation, the meridional circulation, and in terms of the dynamo processes. It's a tall order. There's a lot of complicated things happening in the Taku Climb. Penetrative convection with shear and pumping, the Overshoot region is probably less than 1% of the solar radius, so it's difficult to resolve in a global model. So we'll do what we can. Right now we artificially widen it by reducing the sub-adiabatic stratification in the radiated interior. But we want to push up that stratification and make it more stiff to approach what's more like the sun. There's a lot of things to investigate in the Taku Climb with not only the convection models but other models. Magneto-shear instabilities, both the global ones that I showed a movie of this morning and local ones such as the magneto-rotational instability. Gravity wave generation, how it interacts with shear and magnetic fields, how is the Taku Climb confined, and how does the radiative interior couple to the convection zone through the Taku Climb. So the second thing we need to understand is the top. How do these things couple to the surface? Right now our most ambitious simulations go up to a 0.98 R sun, and the big question is how do these motions couple to supergranulation and granulation, which lies above? So one avenue to investigate that is to actually couple to these near surface simulations, and we can compare these patterns, as I was talking about this morning, with subsurface weather diagrams and make as much contact as we can. And we can investigate this question of magnetic helicity flux through the photosphere and what effect that has on dynamo action. The third objective is to narrow the gap between global convection simulations and mean field dynamo models and eventually approach something that spans the solar activity cycle with these calculations and makes as much contact as we can with the global solar dynamo. This is the most ambitious, and it presupposes objectives 1 and 2, unless we understand the Taku Climb and what's going on near the surface, we won't achieve it. So this is a more longer term objective. And another part of this is to put in some more subgrid scale modeling. In order to run these simulations for decades, we can't run them at extremely high resolution. So we would need to run them at intermediate resolution and somehow parameterize stuff that we can't resolve. So how can HMI help? I think at the top of the list is meridional circulation. As I said, there are reasons to believe it might be a surface thing, that the poleward circulation that we see might be associated with the subsurface shear layer. So it's essential that we try to figure out what the circulation is doing below the subsurface shear layer, and that has implications for dynamo modeling. Subsurface weather maps, we can look for any indications of these north-south lanes of horizontal convergence or downflow, as I talked about this morning, and any indication of latitudinal entropy variations and temperature variations. As I said, if the global convection models and mean field models, most of them predict now that the pole should be relatively warm, that there should be dSd theta, relatively high entropy poles and low entropy equator near the base of the convection zone or the lower half of the convection zone. And if we could, again, it's about 10 Kelvin or 1 part in 10 to the 5, and if we could detect this with local or global inversions. That would be immensely useful. And anything you can say about correlations, velocity variables, thermal variables, correlations between magnetic field and velocity, these are always essential to interpret the underlying dynamics. For example, any kind of correlation between vertical velocity and temperature and supergranulation would tell us that that's a convective phenomenon as opposed to a self-organization of granules. And any kind of non-axisymmetric patterns in flux emergence might tell us about tachocline instabilities, both magneto shear instabilities in the tachocline and buoyancy instabilities in the tachocline. And anything we can say about Jetson oscillations, torsional oscillations are reflective of dynamo processes. Tachocline oscillations could reflect interactions between gravity waves and shear. So anything that can be, and finally, as I said, magnetic helicity flux through the photosphere has implications for global dynamo action. So,
Roger.
Usually not try, so I talk very loud, but I try to use the microphone and talk softly. Let's see. Bob asked me to review some of the work that's been done in artificial data, and I actually, when I read the email, I didn't realize that he wanted me to cover everybody, but I have to say that there are other groups that are interested in that are working in that area. Yeah. Is it turned on or not? Maybe not. Okay. Is that better?
No.
No. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, I can talk very loudly. Don't worry about that.
Well,
now I don't want to do that. Anyways, so the. There are other groups that are also working on artificial data, mainly in Colorado and other places, and at Stanford. But that would not be covering them. Joe Worm and Birch and his group are working on that. And then there's a group at Stanford with Lockheed. I think they're involved in that. But I didn't get a chance to get any of the results. But what I'll show you today is what we're doing in terms of acoustic waves in a sphere, and then what Sasha and Constantina are doing in terms of acoustic waves in a box. And then I'd like to also show you some of the work that Alan Rain's been doing for the full Navier-Stokes, similar to the work that Bob has shown me. So let's see. Okay, so this is the work for the acoustic waves in the sphere. Essentially what we're solving the continuity equation and the momentum equation, and then there is a damping layer outside the sun radius, and we have a random forcing at the shell about the under just below the radius of the stone. The method we have developed is a spherical harmonics in the two directions, and in the radial direction we expand in basis spline, and what this allows us to do is it will allow us to drop the modes as we move to the center and completely go through the center without having to worry about the center singularity. Now this has many advantages in the sense that as the sound speed goes up, you don't have to reduce your time step. And you know, you can also, so what I'm showing there are just the size of the scales, because you're actually living in Fourier. You're living in L, M, and basis function space when you're doing this computation. essentially, what we're doing with the density is the polynomials are expanded as R to the L times a second order polynomial.
Are you throwing away spherical harmonics as you go to the center too?
You can if you want.
Are you?
Yes. Well, not in the simulation that I'll be showing you, we're not, but you can. You have that capability with the B-spline. So you can reduce, you can become coarser and coarser also in the other two directions. So these are the results for the power spectrum for the at L as function of frequency, and you can see that if you look at the frequencies, you can see that we're capturing them at the right location. There are issues here where we have cancellation of two waves, I guess, and we're talking with Tom Duval to understand these, and I was talking to Sasha, and he said it might be our Fourier transform, the way we're computing the L nu diagram. So we're still trying to debug that capability. Yes.
So your random source is at a particular depth.
Yes.
That's probably what's causing those minima in the spectrum.
They're at the one layer.
Yeah.
So. This could be because of the symmetry. Yeah, one wave going one way and the other wave going the other way. This is the simulation for the full sun, and you can see we're going through the center. No problem. These are just acoustic wave oscillations.
Is there any signal at the center?
Very, very. There are only the L equal to whatever zero mode that would pass through it. The other work is by Constantine and Sasha. Essentially, they're solving the linearized Euler equations, and what they do is they put in damping layers on both sides of the box, and then they have a very clean upper boundary condition and lower boundary condition. Their main interest is in gravity waves, and so they're doing the gravity problem. But before we talk about that, so essentially what they did with the gravity is they modified the profiles to get rid of the unstable, where DSDR is positive. So they essentially clip the sound speed profile. They clip actually the entropy profile. So this is a simulation. I have two more minutes. So this is a simulation of a wave going into a disturbance that's supposed to simulate a sunspot. This is and then they do the study at a different location, and what I thought was very clever is if you take your signal if you look at a plane and you take your signal in the y direction and you take your signal in the x direction and compare them, you can actually detect the delay that's through the sunspot. The last thing that I want to show is the work that Alan Ray is doing. Essentially, it's the same box that Bob was showing, except that we go a lot deeper. And here we can show that our code is completely parallelized. I won't go into the details since I'm running out of time. What I'd like to do is show you. This is the movie of the scalar. The other one is the movie of the vorticity, I believe.
just to set the, that you get a blob that goes way deep. And as you can see, the deeper you go, the deeper your structure goes. And your structure becomes coarser and coarser as you're moving deeper and deeper into the simulation. So in this case, we have 40 megameters, 50 by 50. And this is 500 cube around. And that's it.
Thank you. Shinwei?
Yes.
During the transition, can we ask you or Alan, how long have you run this three-dimensional 512 cube box?
How long has
in solar time?
3D. Oh, how long did that run?
In solar time.
About 40,000 seconds.
Okay, so has it equilibrated in any fashion?
No, I would say it's not equilibrated. Boundary conditions are no penetration and hydrostatic pressure. Not the best, but boundary conditions are a real issue.
Guys, it's our pizza.
Okay. All right, let me first show one last slide from my talk at HMI last year meeting. So this is my last slide. What I said was validation of local heliseismology techniques. Is dependent on realistic numerical simulations that have sufficient spatial size and sufficient durations. So numerical simulations are being carried out by a few groups, and we are waiting for your numerical simulation results. That's what I said last year. And during this year, great achievements have been made since then. So like Bob has presented, realistic three-dimensional simulations of a solar convection zone has been performed. So I don't go into details of these parameters. And the other simulation is just like Nadi has presented. Some interesting results have been achieved by Konstantin and Sasha at Stanford group. So I will not go into details for this one either. There may be also a few other works. Sorry that I cannot include in this 7 minutes talk. So by use of MSU simulations performed by Bob and the colleagues, we did power spectrum analysis. So this one is from numerical simulations, and this one is from real observations. They do match pretty well, but let me point out where they do not match well. First, this part. We don't know what those are. And the second part is for the high frequency part. So look at simulations. The signals do not decay away as fast as the real observations. The next work we did was by use of these simulations, we perform time distance diagram computations. This is diagram, time distance diagram computation, which shows the distance and time travel times relationships. So this one is from the numerical simulation, and this one is from real observations. So this dashed line is the theoretical expectation. So they do match pretty well. And what's remarkable here is
for even for the numerical simulations, we saw the second rebounds. So I think this is pretty remarkable. And the next thing we did was to compute travel time maps from FMODs. So this one is from time distance computations by use of outgoing travel times and ingoing travel times. This is the differences of these two travel times, which is corresponding to the negative divergence, which it should be corresponding to the negative divergence. And this one is the divergence computed directly from numerical simulations. And comparing these two plots, we found lots of similarities. And the correlation coefficient is about 0.83, which is very remarkable, very wonderful. And how about velocities? So from time distance, you can compute north and south going travel time differences, which is corresponding to the negative y direction velocities. And comparing with these two figures, we can also find many similarities. The correlation coefficient is about 0.73. Now, what else do we expect from these simulations? No wonder these simulations are already very close to the reality. Some simulations give us a good opportunity to validate time distance analysis. And on the other hand, our analysis is able to check how realistic such simulations are. As I pointed out, the power distribution from simulation is a little different with what computed from real observations, mainly in the low and high frequencies. So we need to, simulators need to improve this. And the other thing is, what we want is the presence of magnetic field, which is very important. What we expect is not just in small magnetic element scales, but in the scale of sensibles. It is of great interest to validate our analysis in sensible areas, including both sound speed variations and flow fields. This simulation is about super granular scale flows. And what we want also is larger scale flows, for example, rotational or meridional flows. The other work is performed by Konstantin and Sasha from Stanford Group. This is from a different perspective. This is from another perspective. They give an artificial oscillation below solar surface and study the acoustic wave field and the wave propagations. This is one time distance relationship from their simulations. For details, please go to Konstantin's presentation in session H9 on Friday morning. So what else do we expect from such simulations? So I have a few ideas. Sensitivity girl kernels. This simulation should be able to construct time distance sensitivity kernels, which can be used to do inversions. And also these kernels can test the existed real approximation, Born approximation kernels. And again, magnetic. We want to know how the acoustic wave field interact with the magnetic field inside the sensibles, as well as how acoustic propagation responds to temperature variations inside the sensibile. Again, flows. We want to know how acoustic waves respond to flow fields. Also, simple experiment of suppressing oscillation amplitudes, then monitoring the changes of acoustic wave field caused by the suppression would help us to better understand the masking effect, which has been talked by Paul Radguru for a while. Apparently, simulation with magnetic field can provide a tool to study the shower glass effect, which will be helpful to understand Charlie's questions. Overall, simulations and observations can help each other. Once again, what I want to stress here is the incorporation of sensible scale magnetic field into simulations and various scales of flow fields. very important for us to test various skills of paleoseismology inversion results. With recent great achievements in the past 1 year, we are confident that simulators will provide us very nice simulations in the years to come. Thanks.
Brad?
Brad's not feeling well.
Oh, so you're going to do it, Deborah?
Okay.
While we're switching over, there was a question.
Yes.
Did you use rake kernels when you sort of reconstructed the flow through the mesh mode? Was it just a...
Oh, this is just measurements. It didn't use any inversions.
Okay, I'm just giving a list, basically, of what we would like from the simulators. So what we'd like to be able to understand is what the P-mode line shape is in the presence of magnetism or turbulent convection. I mean, we've been using Lorentzian profiles, and we know that's not the best thing to do. So anything that could help us understand how to better our fitting codes would be good. Mainly, we'd like to have large enough regions. Right now, the ring analysis, the smallest regions we've looked at are the 20 megameters, but we'd really like to be able to verify the 15 degree patches, and those are like 180 megameters, so we would need a much larger region at some point. And it looks like they are now going deep enough. The 20 megameters deep is fine for what we can understand. And it looks like you'll be able to get long enough duration. We'd ideally like to have, say, 24 hours, but 8 hours probably will be sufficient. Yeah, so that would be great. The other thing is that we need a sufficiently complicated flow field. So we'd like to see some sharp gradients, and also in the spatial direction. So if we are trying to use these smaller ring analyses to be able to have a varying flow field from one section to another to see whether we can actually pick up shearing flows or how accurately we can do that. A lot of the things that were brought up for the time distance analyses are fine for us as well. And actually, we've never actually had a verification of the whole ring analysis from first principles, in the sense that if you have flows or oscillations in the presence of flows, whether you really are picking up the flow field. So a flow gradient in depth would also be incredibly useful. And the absorption effects that, or the suppression of the amplitudes that Jean-Louis was talking about would be very important for ring analysis as well. We would need larger spatial areas so that you could determine the difference between where the suppression was taking place and where you were doing your ring analysis to see whether that affected your the fitting codes. So, I don't know, Rachel or Rene, do you have anything to add on how we could add for ring analysis? Or that's going to come up in the discussion afterwards?
Yeah.
So, that's it for me.
Charlie?
Thank you.
So this is our last talk, and then we'll be having our general discussion.
Yes, this is.
If you can't,
this
oh, that's good. Oh.
Do you want this or you want to?
Yeah, but how do we flip the pages?
You can just use arrows.
Arrows, okay, good. Okay, great. Thanks. Thank you very much. You're right. Yeah. Well, over the last, since the 1960s, acoustic emission from turbulence has been attributed by various studies to nonlinear terms in the hydrodynamic equations that the result of which have led many of these people, and this includes Bob Stein, John Liebacher, Goldreich, Keeley, Goldreich and Kumar, and so on, and quite a few others, have led many of these studies to conclude that acoustic emission, that is the power that you see, ought to be a pretty high power of the turbulent Mach numbers involved, ought to be a rapidly increasing function of those. And this then has led people like Tim Brown to suggest that acoustic emission ought to be episodic and relatively localized, the idea being that the minority of the localities that have the higher Mach numbers have contribute a disproportionate amount of the acoustic emission. So one of the things that we're interested in is ways to look for that. Now, I'm not going to try to go through all the details. Alina Donia and I actually posted a poster to suggest the way we would go about this using a seismic holography, whose purpose is to actually get the kind of local discrimination that would be useful in such a diagnostic. The idea is that if you look at the acoustic field that results from randomly distributed emitters, episodic emitters, that is instances in which a wave packet is emitted, and apply diagnostics to it, it basically gives you snapshots of the sources. If you do various statistics on these holographic images, what you get depends a lot on how episodic things are. In this particular case, for example, if you apply statistics to a relatively sparse distribution, then the distribution in acoustic power, this is basically the log of the distribution, deviates considerably from anything that's exponential. Now, the more dense the distributions get down here, then the more it looks like Gaussian noise, and the less it deviates from exponential, meaning the more difficult it is to see that the distribution is episodic and localized. So I won't actually go into that anymore. It's just that, except to say that we're sort of on the threshold where this ought to be possible to do. But the thing that we really have right now that we haven't had in the era of MDI is excellent simulations, realistic simulations of acoustic emission to apply this same diagnostic to as a control. So now there are a number of other experiments that we want to do in the era of HMI, things like, for example, Mark Rast and Roar Skartlian have suggested that acoustic emission is going to turn out to be correlated to where you are in the granule, the proximity to intergranule lanes, so we can do statistics on things like the holographic signatures and where the acoustic power is related to where you are in the intergranular lane, et cetera, and so on. But once again, we really need control computations because we now know that intergranular lanes are more likely to be magnetic, and magnetic fields suppress the acoustic emission, and so the problem is a little bit more complicated. Just going to stop there then.
Thanks. Okay, and now open for discussion.
Hi, could I just say that as an addendum to Nagi's talk, I have a fully working acoustic simulation that goes from deep within about 0.2 solar radii to into the evanescent region, and we've validated the code, et cetera, et cetera. So if people are interested in getting artificial data, it does a full spherical calculation, so please let me know. Right now, I mean, so the computationally we're a little limited, so it's about 144 the latitude, 288 the longitude. I guess right, we plan to go a little bigger than that. So, and yes, we have the capability to do sunspots. I mean, it's a linear acoustic computation, it doesn't have magnetic fields in it, but so if anyone's interested, that's all. Thanks.
Related to Charlie's talk, maybe I could ask Bob, how episodic is the acoustic emission?
Well, it certainly is much stronger in the downdrafts. And there's a picture in our 2001 paper which shows that. So it's localized in space. I don't know that it's very episodic. Maybe that small box, which was what we were using at the time, did not have a, it wasn't a long enough run or a big enough box to see very strong shocks. We see a few of them, but I haven't looked to see whether they're producing significantly more acoustic power.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Charlie if he had tried to use different sets of modes to apply the holographic technique to derive the acoustic emission maps, and to see if we get similar answers for different sets of modes.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. In a way, we have, because for one thing, in our computations, we concentrated on just the high frequencies. And this is something that's described briefly a little bit more in our poster. If you go to the low frequencies, whatever you see has to compete with oscillations that have accumulated, or basically receive stuff that was emitted from a long distance away. So all of the people who have, suggested this have said high frequencies is where you want to do it, which is not where most of the power actually exists, but it is where most of the power is actually is being created. And then there are other distinctions that I can talk about with you.
May I ask you, Bob, where do you see, what's the thrust of these simulations of your granulation driving acoustic waves in small boxes? What is its predictive capability? Why are you doing it? And where would you go?
I think in terms of the excitation of the P-modes, we've done more or less what we wanted to do. I think the things we're concentrating on now are somewhat different than that. But but the data from that original stuff is still there. If people have a different question they want to ask of it.
Could you comment upon what are the weaknesses of what you've done compared to the sun?
Well, there's lots.
there's some significant ones.
Well, first place, we don't have nearly the range of scales that the sun has. I think that's probably the most significant, and something that we're doing better now, but we're never going to get really close. One of the things we are working on is improving the radiation treatment. There are some discrepancies between the center to limb variations and the old things, which we think are better matched now with the better treatment of the radiation. That has some implications, for instance, for the abundance analysis that Martin Asman did. And I've been working with his postdoc, he's a former graduate student of mine, to improve that. So, but I think our two big thrusts is what I put up on the slide. One is doing these large scale things, which it would be difficult for us to make much deeper, but we could easily make bigger if that was really important, wider. If we get enough time on a place like on a computer like the Columbia one, because we really have to run it for a very long time. And the other is to do really high resolution things with the magnetic fields on the smaller scale, to look at the role of, for instance, the magnetic instabilities in the vacuum. But personally, I think we understand now the excitation of the modes. I was not planning on pursuing that further.
So I'd like to make a brief comment about, about the intermittency of acoustic events. The Mach number to the seventh Goldreich and Kumar result comes from a particular excitation mechanism. Reynolds stresses basically parcels of gas crashing together to excite acoustic waves. There's significant observational and theoretical evidence that that's not the mechanism which excites acoustic waves, that in fact acoustic waves are excited by thermal perturbations in the solar photosphere, and that those perturbations are actually observed, contribute to the line shapes of the acoustic modes, in which case some simple modeling indicates that the intermittency, the events might not be that intermittent. Every granule which fragments, which is roughly 60% of them, produces a new downflow plume which excites acoustic waves by radiative cooling in the photosphere. So I think there's evidence within the spectrum that I'll talk about on Friday for us actually observing the acoustic events, and it's not the quadrupolar events that have been discussed previously.
But what we found certainly agrees with that. And I think that Dolly, you actually did a comparison of the Reynolds stress excitation with the entropy fluctuations excitation.
Well, there's continuous small granular events producing excitation sources. And they're, as I'll discuss on Friday more thoroughly, they're associated with cooling events in the photosphere. So there's a particular phase relationship between the intensity fluctuation and the velocity fluctuation associated with acoustic events. And that's the signal that you can see very clearly in the spectrum.
This is on a slightly different topic. For all the simulators, is there data now that we can use to run a hare and hound experiments, much like the global folks did, so that we can test our inversion codes?
At the moment, all we have on this large scale is 8.5 hours without a magnetic field and also without the rotation. But we are currently...
Velocity gradient?
Oh, yeah. Well, no. There is no shear layer because it doesn't have the rotation. But we're currently in the process of running the bigger one, and we get about two to three solar hours a week. So they'll soon be stuff.
Mark Mish mentioned that the possibility of merging global simulations with local, with agent surface, so I wonder what perspective for this, because we cannot use global modeling as inelastic, so there's no way there.
I can address that, or maybe Neil can address that. They have a recent SR&T proposal that was just Neil and Mark DeRosa and Mark Rast and company have a proposal. Did you want to say something about that, coupling the CSS code to ASH?
Yeah, we have this a new proposal that's just funded to look at the how do you bring the inelastic sort of approximations nearer to the surface. And the idea is to take the large scale models and apply the inelastic model and use those as essentially drivers to drive a fully compressible small localized model, and we're just getting started on that, so hopefully we'll have something to report next time we meet.
I could add a little bit to that. We also have thought about playing with boundary conditions at the top, putting in the small scale entropy rain to look at the influence of granulation and supergranulation on larger scale motions, so we can play with boundary conditions too. But before I yield this, I wanted to ask a question mainly to Charlie and Doug and anybody else who wants to address it. But I was wondering, what's the current limitation on the predictive capability of far-side imaging? Is it the signal-to-noise ratio of the observations, or is it uncertainty about the inversions? And can forward modeling progress that and contribute to that at all?
Oh, why don't you go ahead.
Okay. You want the long answer or the short answer?
Please work on it more recently.
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short because I believe that the limit right now is pretty close to just realization noise statistics available from the modes that exist in the time that exists. Might be improved on a little. I don't see that simulations of how that noise is produced will actually figure into it. I don't think
about. Just to follow up on what Neil and Mark were talking about, there's clearly now an overlap between where the interior ones can go up to and the top ones can go down to. So there can be coupling done now between them.
I just heard from Charlie that realization noise is a limitation. It seems to me that if you know where the sources are, you can take it out.
Right. We don't, so we can't. let me just point out, actually, that far-side imaging really depends on waves not being produced, but the waves that are lasting long enough to get from there to here and back. And so it's really not the waves, the production of the waves, that's the key to that. It's the waves that have been there for a long time and are just rattling around.
Just to clarify, when I asked if forward modeling could be useful, I didn't mean in the generation of waves or in the noise part. I meant a simulation like what Naji talked about or what Chavron's doing of spherical shell simulations of acoustic wave propagation and then putting in something on the far side and looking at a signature on the near side. And can significant advances be made with that?
Yeah, the answer to that is yes.
Extremely short, Charlie.
Hey, you're in motor cycle. Excuse me.
I have a second one.
Are you asking about whether you can map structure on the far side of the sun? Is that what your question is aimed at?
I'm just asking if progress can be made with the emergence with the problem of you have acoustic waves in a circle shell and you have some kind of perturbation on the other side, cloud seed perturbation or magnetic perturbation.
Right.
And you're asking what signature that has on the near side.
Right.
And is that pretty well established, or can we make significant progress?
I mean, do we understand the signatures on the near side?
Yeah, the mapping between the inversions, like from what we measure to what the structure is on the other side.
Yeah, I think in the broad sense, the answer is yes. Just have to do a lot of work to get it. There is an interesting issue that the modes that are coherent are the ones that tell you about the far side, and I forget exactly what range of L again that takes you over to the other side. Those are the ones you want to use. So there's some limit on the resolution that you can get on the far side because you're dealing with modes of below a certain L. I don't know if you can see super granulation. I don't think you can see super granulation on the far hemisphere. You could certainly see, in principle, you could see things like giant cells, banana cells, I would imagine.
Just from experience with playing with the far side, I think one thing that is inhibiting the sensitivity right now is this large center to limb trend that's there. So when you look, when you make your target on the far side move off disk center, you see a change in the phase of the ingression and egression that is three times the size of the signal from active regions. The pupil is very large that you're averaging over, so you're smearing it out. If we could take that out properly, I think it would help. Charlie says he knows what it's coming from, but I didn't quite understand what the answer was.
Right.
Yeah, and I'll avoid that.
Sure.
Just a
simple. Any other?
I'd just like to make a comment, Bob. I don't want to. I don't have anything at all, bad to say about HMI. But I think Ben could. That in the case of acoustic emissions, the thing that we're going to have in things like wave generation by turbulence and helioseismology based on that, one of the major things we're going to have is fantastic simulations for a lot of what we want to do, what we want to understand. MDI is actually excellent. You already get the fraction limited resolution of everything that you can see. But it seems to me that the simulations, this is an area where the simulations are really going to make a major difference.
Well, one of the things that HMI brings that MDI can't is having that resolution all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing it brings is that you'll have it all over the solar disk on one side, which MDI is very fast for.
Sure. Well, it would be
MDI
nice.
Or carbon or something.
I think that in fact, and it'll be a lot of data. I think the fact, the really strikes me about the simulations is 100 hours, 50 to 100 hours or so that we will actually have to, you know, to do the control work. I think that that's really critical.
I'd like to return to one of the major themes of probing the techoclimate. Could we have any comments upon people's plans or ambitions to do deep focusing? We heard some things from the father of the subject yesterday. Can somebody wish to expand further on that? The ability to use time distance with deep focusing?
I plan to do deep focusing.
Let me then make the comment I was planning on making yesterday at the first talk, which is that the real problem of time distance is actually to build a correlation map with enough signal to noise ratio to do the proper fitting to get good time anomalies. Once you have that and you have the appropriate kernels, it's really the inversion that does your focusing. It's not your choice of geometry.
Your mind away.
Better away.
Good. Thank you.
Better. No.
Yeah,
somewhere in the middle is good.
So I think that the problem is really, you know, that I disagree with the idea that you want to actually do your cross-correlation averaging to try to a priori get a better kernel for the inversion. It's really inversion that does the focusing, because the inversion at the end tells what is really a resolution kernel. And therefore what you need is a technique to get the time anomalies and their precision, you know, to be improved, from which you have the underlying kernel, and then you do the best with your inversion. So I'm always puzzled. It reminds me very much about the discussion we did the rotation splitting, where they use the A coefficient or the B coefficient. And the reality is that you want to do what gives you the best estimate of the input of inversion first, and then the inversion, knowing what there is and what is the uncertainty on the measurement, will give you at the end how well of a focusing you can do in the deep layers.
So do you have some feelings for what you would be doing differently to improve that?
But I think the problem is really, you know, trying to improve the signal to noise ratio of the correlation without introducing, you know, possible artifacts to the results of the system. That's, I think, what the challenge is.
I sort of second. I second the idea that one ought to try to develop in a very systematic way, starting from first principles, deep focusing, try to understand it from first principles. That doesn't preclude somebody trying to do something clever and find shortcuts to that. I don't see why, you know, we have to do one or the other, but Sylvan's right. It's time to do deep focusing based on standard inversion techniques and just see what comes out in the systematics program, which is the way I interpret what you're saying.
One thing that's important for time distance diagnostics is to be able to compare what goes into the focus with what's coming out. And that means that you have to look at the surface signature and use that to determine what's going in, the same as what's going out. Of course, since they occur at the same surface, there, you know, is the possibility, or that is the need, to be able to discriminate those. Now, the other point is that it's very nice to be able to do high frequencies. The thing that's different about high frequencies is that what you're actually looking at is stuff that got produced by turbulence. It's not stuff that just came up and came to the surface and reflected anymore, because the surface is a poor reflector. So one thing that we want to be able to use the simulations to get is, what is the relationship between what goes down into the solar interior and what you see directly at the surface? And it seems to me that this is another place where the simulations can really teach us a great deal.
it would seem to me that if you want the longer period things, then it's the deep simulations which you really need for that, because our shallow box doesn't have any of the very low L's. We only go down to about an L of 100.
I actually think that's not a problem, but sometimes I still need to discuss it.
Sasha was going to give us a summary.
By some brief notes during these discussions. So let me show you that so it's clear that what we discussed, the two directions in numerical simulation, so the first is that what Bob is doing and mostly it's adopting realistic models, try to adopt this for, make this useful for Hilly seismology. And the second approach is creating specific artificial data by using simplified models, so that what clearly it's two directions that was very useful. They complement each other, and it's very nice that you have all these. So what modelers do, first we discuss, so that what it's a list of presentations here. So that what we are now having a great progress with non-linear realistic simulations, and already it's on supergranulation scale and even larger, so that it's all making great progress in testing, particularly what impressive function we showed, testing the time distance measurements for F mode. And also that what Bob showed some emergent flux, but unfortunately it's very shallow, so we need to, and probably these high resolution simulations are very useful for understanding actually the process of excitation that will be discussed in great details. And for global simulations, that what Mark Misch presents very interesting topics, that a lot of progress in modeling the actual physics inside the sun. So we need to figure out how to use these simulations actually to link to Hilly seismology. It was not clear to me. So what, how it, we can actually use this. So we can compare the level of, on the physical level, but not actually at the testing level of, so that what it would be very, very important to make this connection. And for artificial data, it also what Nazi showed that what so progress on acoustic waveform sphere and the box, and so that all control experiments, so that here we have great control over what you put in and how we use this data for testing. So that what these two complementary approaches and it's progress in the past year was really tremendous. So that what it's really, so what observers want. So that's a list of topics that we'll discuss here, that for time distance and also fault techniques, that what excitation, that what different terms here, improved power distribution, non-uniform amplitude distribution at magnetic field, acoustic emission sources. So that's obviously the key, because in local Hilly seismology, excitation comes explicitly in kernels. So the kernels are computed, and we put some model of excitation source. So that's very important. And the other issue is that magnetic field is also, let's say, one of the key. We need more simulations of magnetic field. So not much been done so far. And also what large scale flows or complicated flow fields to test inversions. And also suggestions to test sensitivity kernels from simulations. And this probably can be done more easily with the second approach and generate specifically artificial data. So we can just put some point source and then test sensitivity this way. So that also it's important issue of, again, it's about the physics, mode physics, that's a line profile modeling. It's again, it's related to power distribution. It's all related issues and acoustic emission. And of course, for ring diagrams, we need larger simulations, and hopefully we will get these. Because that's what they don't require a great depth. I'm pretty sure that for Bob it's easier to make a bigger box, but not
at the Razzy Shallow, so it's probably doable in the very near future. So that was, this was an important note. So we can extend this existing simulations for implication ring diagrams. So for holography, it's in addition to acoustic sources, it's important to model the far side signal. That was, it's pretty clear that what, that it's one of the important issues for modeling, and it's probably that what can be done on the simulations based on SPHEREM. So at the end, so that what we need, basically what I think the general conclusion was of this discussion, that we need official data plus also some understanding of wave physics. So that what we're not just, the simulation is not just used for testing kernels and procedures, but also we get great deal of understanding of wave physics. And I want to finish by showing my favorite movie of wave propagation, magnetic fields, or magnetic field lines. And this line shows beta equal one plane. So that's it's somewhere above the photosphere, but it's not important here. So that what, which is I cannot see here on the screen. I cannot get precisely the same to start this movie. So you can see that the waves, they come from below the interacting magnetic field, in particular beta equal one plane. There's a strong interaction. So that's a transformation, it's a different modes are excited here. So not much happening below where beta is greater than one. And we need to continue. It was another paper published in 2000 by Keith Julian and Colin Rosenthal, and where they look at interaction between P modes and F modes with sunspots. And what they concluded that this transformation is particularly important for F mode, but for P modes, because they're reflected below the surface where beta is greater than one, this transformation doesn't happen in the simulations. So we need to continue also that what this type of modeling that what it's very crucial for interpretation, but particularly for recent measurements that what holography people did and also Jinwei did, that's called Kleinfeld effect. So we need also some understanding of wave physics in addition to creating artificial data. So that's all my comments.
Thanks, Sasha. That was a nice summary. So let me just double check to make sure that I've got it straight. What I'm hearing is that what people most want is to have simulations with an active region. I've heard that from Deborah, from Sasha, from Charlie. And the other thing is that people would like something that goes wider than what we have now, again, both for the time distance and for the ring diagram analysis. Those were, as I think both from Sasha's summary and from the discussion, those were the two biggest things, and at least for us, both of those are doable. Yuri?
Well, similarly, you'd like to have some simulations that actually have some mean flows associated with them, as opposed to churning away locally. Because some of the issues are, can you detect?
Yeah. Well, we have a mean differential rotation. The meridional circulation we get is somewhat like what Mark gets, that is, it's quite fluctuating.
This is something on the F plane.
That's right. Because remember, we're in a rectangular box. That's why it's, I think these are very complementary kinds of things. The people who are doing the spherical shells and the kind of thing that we're doing, you need them both. Yes?
Well, just to advocate that, yes, besides that you want an active region and all nice things in it, but you also wanted a control experiment where you have nothing in it and no flow, because if we get a flow out, guess what? We're in trouble. So, so yes, I urge to have a control experiment as well.
You need to start by the simplest test.
Well, one has to do that anyway. That is, what we've run now is without a magnetic field.
Right.
And then you put in a magnetic field, then we put in an active region. It's going to have them all.
In a way, Rudy is also asking for a standard solar model. Because in local area seismology, not only we need the density pressure and all these things, but we also need
correlation that Lakshmi was talking about a few hours back, that give us the forcing terms for the waves. Yeah, so it's a combination of these correlations and the background model that make up the standard solar model for local waves, I suppose. Horizontal averages.
Obviously, if you have 3D, you can always make averages.
Sure, but can we somehow enough today compute these averages to everyone? Then
I don't think we have a long enough run yet to get a good statistical average, but we certainly will after we've run it for several turnover times. I guess the one thing which I didn't make clear is that we have run a smaller scale thing, that 24 megameters wide, for over two solar days. And so that might be, it's not good enough for the seismology, but it might be good enough to get a fairly good mean state.
Well, earlier this morning and also yesterday, Dean Esnell was asking, are there certain tasks that could be carried out on Columbia, Project Columbia, for instance, that were beyond sort of one's personal research, but still dependent upon, would have real implications for what happens with interpretation of STO results. Certainly some of those simulations are in that class. Although, I guess the question that I would like to ask Phil is that is there something equivalent to the Howard Hughes Foundation that can actually fund these things? Because NASA doesn't seem to be in that game anymore. It builds large instruments, but we don't analyze anything. So have you any advice on that, Phil, from the discussions you might have had yesterday or in the future?
I'd say to write your congressman. I'd say not to write them, but to go stand in their office. I think that the problem is beyond the local levels in NASA. That problem. But it's a specific question that I have, that in case not all of the consumers of supercomputer time might be at the meeting this afternoon, and that is, what scale are we talking about? How many Columbias do you need for how long?
I don't know if it's how many Columbias, it's what fraction of Columbia we need.
$4 million node hours per year.
We just put in a proposal for Columbia for $7 million. And of course, we don't expect to get the whole thing, but it'll probably come down to about what you were saying. So that's the scale.
Just coming back to this question of what we need, bearing in mind what Charlie said about realization noise. Of course, any given simulation will be one particular realization over that time period. It just seems to me that what we need are quite a few times longer time series than what we actually want to use in the analyses.
That's a good point.
Oh, I just made a simple calculation that tells us that what we will actually have in our computer room per year is something of that order. Now, we do have other uses in mind apart from that.
On Columbia, they opened up a system of 2,000 CPUs for people to do bigger scales. We'll see how that actually works out.
It's of course not the right architecture for that. It was just a curiosity. I'm not suggesting.
Can I do something that just is a straw poll type of thing? And that question would be, how many people in the room are counting on support from NASA over the next 3 years to be able to do these things? Just a rough show of hands. How many FTEs do we need? Right?
What
just
He's preaching to the choir at the moment.
I'm preaching to the choir at the moment, but I was wondering if we should do a question like that at the dinner, when everybody's there.
Mm-hmm. No, everyone's gone.
Some of us won't be.
Everyone's gone.
No.
But
witnesses are gone.
I was thinking of putting a little red dot on the bottom of 15 plates or something. Everybody that has, raise your hands if you need money. Put those down. Everybody that has a red dot, raise their hand. And if you see a discrepancy in the number of hands, there's a problem. But I think Nas is well aware of the problem, that Pay D for SDO is dramatically underfunded in the plans.
Awareness and doing something about it.
Awareness and doing something and being able to do something about it are different things. And it looks like from what we learned yesterday, the FYO 7 budget is not going to help much. And the 8 is not going to help much. It's 8 and 9 and 10 we have to be working on.
I think your suggestion of going to the congressman is probably an excellent one. I was actually intending to do that for ours, as a staunch Republican.
And while doing that, be sensitive to what's happened to our colleagues in astrophysics.
What do you mean?
They've been obliterated by the present motion.
Before you go to your congressman, just do some deep focusing.
Do you think documenting conclusions of what we decide we need in this meeting is useful fodder for discussions like that? Or no? You don't think it's a useful exercise?
It's at a national level.
Well, it seems to me that the perception is probably that although they're supporting basic research, they don't consider this basic research. And I think that's one of the things that they have to be educated on, that this is basic research.
NASA supports missions, not research.
Okay, thank you all very much. I think this has been a very productive session. I appreciate your inputs.
Hundreds of millions of dollars putting something in order.
Make it.
Yeah.
Good luck.
I mean, we're doing our 20 megameters in 16 adding out. So, with that,